Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz probes a tweet by Bryce Canyon National Park. Fear permeates local immigrant communities in the wake of new enforcement guidelines from the Trump administration. Legislation that targets polygamists advances in the Utah House of Representatives. And a proposal to raise the sales tax on food draws criticism from low-income advocates. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune managing editor David Noyce. Dave, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Justice and safety reporter Nate Carlisle. Welcome, Nate.
Thank you for having me.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. Welcome to you as well, Robert.
Thank you. Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this conversation as well during this Friday morning news wrap-up. The number to call is 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. The Trump administration unveiled plans to speed deportations and expand sweeps of people who are in the United States illegally. New guidelines on immigration enforcement that are still kind of coming into focus. Dave Noyce, could you kind of lay this out for us and tell us how Utah's political leaders and immigrants in the state are responding to this new these new guidelines?
Not surprisingly, they're responding in opposite ways. The Trump administration unveiled guidelines, and of course, his supporters would say this is him delivering on his longtime promises during the campaign that he was going to get tough on illegal immigrants. He is going to, of course, try to bolster Border Patrol, 5,000 new Border Patrol security agents and 10,000 more enforcement, ICE enforcement agents, with the goal of deporting or at least detaining and beginning the process of deporting illegal immigrants. The big change is, of course, that he is basically the administration has essentially removed a lot of previous administrations, which just basically went after serious offenders of crimes and things like that, violent crimes and other serious crimes, before they would usually look at that. He's basically removed those. A person could be deported for a traffic violation, ostensibly. Of course, we'll have to see how this all carries out. This comes in the wake of at least 400 or 500 people have been swept up in rage just in the past week, including four in Park City. The congressional delegation, Senator Orrin Hatch, essentially said it's about time. This was supposed to happen. This is common sense. Jason Chaffetz also chimed in and essentially echoed support for it. The activist community, immigration advocates are worried. There's a tremendous fear in the community about what this means, to the point that some people are, even people who have papers and are documented, fear going out of their house, sending their kids to school, those kinds of things. The Mexican consulate in town recently had a Know Your Rights kind of meeting. They have those from time to time anyway, and there's usually, you know, 20, 30, 40, maybe 50 people come. It was packed this week. So we reported a story on that, of them basically being schooled on what to do and how to handle the situation when it arises.
Right. Part of it is knowing your rights, and then the other part of it was, yeah, exactly, being prepared for, you know, hearing advice on what you should do in the event of immigration raids or raids by immigration officials. Like you said, Dave, this is broadening who is a priority for deportation. One part of this is trying to get local law enforcement to join in the federal enforcement effort, and that is something that here in Salt Lake City, at least, local law enforcement has been has said that they won't do. Is that right?
And they echoed that again. At least Salt Lake City Sheriff and the Salt Lake City Police have echoed that and repeated that they're not going to become essentially immigration enforcers But of course, we'll see what happens and how other agencies handle it throughout the state. And I think time may have to tell exactly how it's going to be enforced, how it's going to be done. I could see a real patchwork of enforcement, which could lead to all kinds of different issues. The ACLU's warned that this may go extra-constitutional, outside of constitutional bounds. So we'll have to see. I suspect there'll be lawsuits and things like that, depending on how this comes down.
And are there resources available for carrying out this plan as it has kind of been unveiled? Robert Gierke, this is distinct from, but maybe not altogether different from, the travel ban and refugee sort of moratorium from last month. Mm-hmm. As an opinion columnist, you get to opine on this, a crackdown of sorts. What does it mean for the country and for our community?
Well, I think Dave hit on it when we're still trying to see what it's going to mean in application. You don't hire 15,000 new agents without having something big planned. But Congress also is going to have to fund that, and those aren't cheap positions. We're talking millions of dollars to try to get those agents on the ground. I think more immediately, the big problem that it's causing is that it's causing a lot of fear in these communities, and these communities, members of these communities are not willing now to work with police, to report crimes, to interact with police on day-to-day things. And that's a big problem. And the other question I think we have to see is how the deferred access or the DACA program for the Dreamers, these are kids whose parents brought them to the country when they were young, and the Obama administration created this registry where you can sign up and you know, not risk deportation while you're going to school. You know, in some cases, these people have been here for, you know, 15 years more. You know, they've grown up here. It's the only country they've ever known. So the Obama administration allowed them to finish school. There is legislation in Congress that would sort of extend that. But as it stands right now, the Trump administration seems to be intent on getting rid of that as well. So, I mean, it's a fairly significant crackdown on people who've really only ever known this country. And you know, as Dave noted, it's what Trump said he was going to do from day one of the campaign, and he was pretty blunt about it. I don't know if everybody believed that it was going to happen, but now it is, and the communities that interact with these immigrants are being left to deal with it, you know, as best they can.
You mentioned DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. I know that there was a resolution presented before the, I think it was the Board of Education. I'm not certain if anybody can address it here in the studio, that was trying to prevent immigration officials from accessing information in schools. Dave Noyce, can you
address that? A group, another large group turned out to the Salt Lake City School Board to try to essentially get the board to sign off or endorse a hands-off kind of in the schools. Now, the schools would not cooperate with immigration officials and things like that. School board members listened and ended up taking that under advisement. They tried to reassure the community that there's lots of protections already through federal privacy acts for students and things like that. I don't think that pacified that community much. They're very worried. I mean, it's gotten to the point of, like with the Mexican consulate, they were advising people have someone to turn to if you get arrested. So, you know, and if your parents are in jail, so that someone can take care of your kids. So this is a real fear to people on the ground at the grassroots.
Have phone numbers memorized and so on. Yeah, Robert Gierke.
And Dave noted this, but the reaction of the congressional delegation, perhaps not Jason Chaffetz's reaction, because you remember Jason Chaffetz famously advocated for tent cities for illegal immigrants, internment camps, basically, when he was running in the first time. But Orrin Hatch over the years has been a big supporter of the DREAM Act and not deporting these students. And now to have him come out and say just the opposite, he backtracked when he was running for reelection because it's basically cowardice, you know, and his putting his own political career ahead of trying to, you know, keep these families together. And so I don't anticipate that we'll see anything different from Orrin Hatch again, because he's gearing up to run for re-election again, and he's not going to buck the Trump administration. He's shown that much.
Is there a little bit of gray area here, especially I'm thinking about the Dreamers, the childhood arrivers, because the Trump administration, or at least Trump himself, has said that that he wants those people to be not, you know, to be left alone, essentially. But the guidelines on enforcement maybe are kind of vague there.
Right. They're still trying to clarify that, because there have been Dreamers who, you know, people who have been covered by the DACA program who have been involved in these roundups, including, I think, one of them in Park City, mm-hmm. if I remember right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's unclear. And when you try to do a big program rounding up millions of people on the fly, I think it's probably going to you're going to have some vagueness in the way it's going to be interpreted and applied.
I want to remind our listeners that we invite you to join the conversation. The number to call is 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Picking up on the thread of things that immigrants and refugees overcome to get to Utah, get to the United States, Robert Gerke, you had a column this past week that spotlighted an Iraqi refugee family living here in Salt Lake City. Maybe tell us about their journey, because the hardships that they overcome are pretty remarkable.
Yeah, this family had to flee Iraq in 2006 because the violence between Shia and Sunni, and they perhaps unfortunately picked Syria to flee to. Reestablished roots there, and then when the civil war broke out in Syria, the employer that this guy was working for, his name is Isan Hamush, was they were targeted by the government. Their offices were raided, and they had to flee back across the border into Kurdistan. All the while, they were trying to get refugee status through the United Nations. It took them years and years. While they were in Kurdistan, just outside of Mosul. Again, ISIS took Mosul. They had to flee. They fled first to Germany. Germany sent them back to Iraq. The point of it is that these people came here, and they said their only desire being in the United States is for their children to get a good education and have a good life and be safe. And I thought it was important to tell their story, because their story is really not that unique to the refugee experience that thousands of refugee families in the state have gone through. And so, you know, right now the Trump travel ban is sort of suspended. They're recasting it or redesigning it. Although the expectation and what's being reported is that it's not going to be significantly different in its scope, but more in the application, I guess, that of the ban. So, you know, and you've got these people. They've settled here, but they have family in Iraq that they would like to be able to come here, or they would like to. The wife of this gentleman said that she wanted to go back and visit her relatives who are in Mosul, but she can't do that because she's afraid that she won't be able to re-enter the country and she'd be separated from her kids.
Right. We've heard some of the reworking of that executive order might include, you know, giving sort of greater warning in advance, and not stopping people who are in the air when they're on their way here. But that's not a change necessarily in policy.
That's an implementation issue more than it is actual practical change in the scope of it.
You know, among other things, the new administration has decreased the number of refugees that the United States will take in by a large number. I don't know the exact number there. That's for people fleeing violence. These are refugees, persecution, fleeing terror. Before moving on to other topics, just one more question to the opinion writer on this. That decrease in refugees is being done, the Trump administration says, in the name of security, in the name of American safety. What about that argument, Robert Gerke?
Well, I think the facts show there was a Pew study that came out recently that showed that immigrants to this country actually are less likely to commit crime than people who are born here. And so these people are not necessarily a security risk. But and as I mentioned with this family that I interviewed, they spent 9 years going through this process of vetting and fingerprint and background checks and on and on and on before they were able to come here. So there is, as Trump calls it, extreme vetting going on right now as it is. And I think, you know, one of the things that both of these issues, I think, call into question is what the response of Utah and Utah leaders are going to be. And we've seen, as we mentioned, Chaffetz and Hatch's comments on the immigration issue. But, you know, Utah's always been over the years, has done a lot to try to be welcoming to immigrants who are here, refugees who are coming here, fleeing violence. And I think it puts to the test our values as a society and our values of our leaders as elected officials.
Well, here's a question, a comment/question out of Hanksville. This is Martin. He says, if people are here illegally, why are we trying to protect them? Why don't we enforce the law or change it? He didn't stay on the phone to take a response there. That's a pretty common, question, I guess, is, you know, the term illegal means something to, you know, that's It's definitionally outside of the law. So why are we doing anything about it?
Well, I mean, the argument on the other side of that is that these people, a lot of them, as we talked about with the Dreamers, came here not by choice necessarily, and as young children, it's the only country they've ever known. I heard a story a couple days ago of a gentleman from Honduras who was detained and sent back to Mexico, which was not where he was from. But he had been in this country for over 30 years, and he had a family here. And there was no, you know, they're sending him back to a country where he's never actually lived. You know, so there is an argument to be made that you don't want to reward people for cutting in line, essentially. But over the years, the Republican Party, at least, portions of the Republican Party have tried to create a path to legal residency, if not citizenship. That seems to be going out the window now, and that's not the philosophy, it appears, of the people who are making the decisions now. And so, you know, there is also the practicality of trying to, you know, round up all of these 11 million people and the economic impact that would have. Studies after study have shown that they actually pay taxes, they contribute to the economy, and they actually don't take money out of the economy in terms of Social Security benefits and things like that. The studies are that Social Security would be bankrupt years earlier if we don't have these immigrants paying into the system.
Contributing to it.
Yeah.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. We've got to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll get the latest from the Utah State Legislature, including a proposed food sales tax increase, changes to polygamy law, some gun-related measures, and more. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor Dave Noyce, Justice and Safety Reporter Nate Carlisle, columnist Robert Gerke, and Public Lands Reporter Brian Maffley. Welcome, Brian.
Hey, thanks.
You can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Let's go now to the state legislature where maybe we should begin by looking at something that every out-of-stater in the United States associates with Utah, and that is the topic of polygamy. Nate Carlisle, changes in how the state enforces polygamy and, I guess, defines, I guess, the crime of polygamy. Tell us about HB 99 and what it would do.
Well, they would certainly change the definition of polygamy, or more specifically, bigamy in Utah. And we having some mic problems.
Oh.
Okay, I'm talking. It would definitely change the definition of bigamy as it relates to polygamy in Utah. It's not quite clear what it would do for enforcement, and I'll explain that in a moment. But
sure.
Basically, the bill would keep bigamy, i.e. polygamy, a third-degree felony, which is punishable by up to 5 years in prison. But it would change the definition to say that you both have to live with the extra spouse and purport to be married to him or her.
And that's a change in that before it had to be just one of those requirements.
That's correct.
Okay.
And but then also, if you're caught practicing polygamy in association with other crimes such as sex abuse or human smuggling or fraud, then the penalties for polygamy can be ramped up to 15 years in prison. And, of course, this all comes about because the sister wives family from the television show sued and won at the federal district court level. It was later overturned for technical reasons, but apparently everyone thinks that the judge's analysis in Sister Wives stands, and so they need to readdress the state statute.
You know, the history of trying to, I guess, enforce the kind of laws like this that have existed on our books is kind of fraught in Utah, going all the way back to raids in the 1950s, the Short Creek raids. This is because it's hard to separate the practice from religious practice. Will this bill, if it passes, be enforceable?
Well, which part of the bill?
I guess any prohibition on polygamy, is that enforceable?
I'll just state the facts here.
Okay.
That this polygamy has been illegal in Utah for a long, long time, at least since statehood, and yet polygamy has persisted in the state. So would the current bill root out all polygamy? I don't think even the sponsors have that hope and dream. I think what they claim they really are trying to target is the more unsavory criminal aspects of it, such as child bride marriages and sex abuse, mm-hmm. and some of the financial fraud that has gone on in some of the sects. And they think that if they attach these extra penalties to polygamy, it would help them be able to pursue those crimes easier. They claim they do not want to target consenting adults that are otherwise not committing any of their crimes.
Okay. Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, a lot of talk about religious freedom in Utah in recent years, that the legislature in particular. Civil libertarians, I believe, generally side with polygamists who are, you know, otherwise not breaking the law. I guess the caveat that we should make is that they side with willing participants,
right,
of polygamy and the polygamous practice. What do you say about all of this?
Right. I don't think anybody outside of that Breitbart guy that got fired this week would condone child marriages or that sort of relationship. But I do think that there is a case to be made, and the civil libertarians and others made it, that we're criminalizing a behavior between consenting adults. We're driving the people, as we talked about with the immigrant population, the people who would report these crimes were stigmatizing and driving them into the shadows and making it harder to enforce. It does give the prosecutors a potential tool if there are cases that arise. But I think Nate mentioned this. All of these things that they're doing in conjunction with polygamy, for the enhanced penalty for things done in conjunction with polygamy, all of those are illegal already. The welfare fraud, the sex trafficking or child sex sex abuse. So what are we trying to accomplish here? I think, you know, there is a constitutional ban on polygamy in this state.
Right.
It's been illegal since statehood, and it's still here. I don't know if we're going to, you know, squelch it by passing another law saying it's really illegal. But this is a statement that particularly Representative Noel, represents that part of the state, feels not that part of the state. I mean the area of Short Creek and Colorado City and Hilldale, that he feels like it's important to have on the books.
You know, that, banning polygamy being a condition of statehood, and 121 years later, we're still kind of grappling with it at the legislature. Nate, frustration expressed by Representative Mike Noel at this committee meeting about the use of the term Mormon by some polygamists. Maybe you can explain that to us.
Yeah, he made abundantly clear on the House floor yesterday, Thursday, that is, that he is offended when fundamentalist Mormons use that second word, Mormon. He thinks that they're an apostate group. He called them an apostate groups, and that it offends him, being a member of the mainstream Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints based here in Salt Lake City. And that it's clearly a motivation why he's running the bill. He's made that abundantly clear. And the interesting thing about that is, to the fundamentalist Mormons, people like Mike Noel is the apostate. I mean, they call themselves the fundamentalist Mormons. Believe they're the true followers of Joseph Smith and practicing his beliefs.
Right. Well, who else testified at this committee meeting? I mean, who was there in favor? Who was there against? And how did this play out?
Well, we've had two hearings on this bill in the House. We had an interesting divide of among former plural wives. Some are completely opposed to polygamy now for all the aforementioned reasons and are in favor of this bill. We have some other former plural wives who, even though they don't like polygamy and think there are some inherent problems with it, think this bill is the wrong way to go about it because it'll just drive it further underground. And then also, as Robert mentioned, you do have some civil libertarians that have sided with the polygamists, thinking that we're criminalizing behavior of consenting adults, that sort of thing. One interesting opponent to the bill was an executive from the Utah Coalition Against Domestic Violence?
I believe so.
Sorry if I'm screwing up that agency's name, but you get the idea of what they oppose generally, and they are opposed to HB 99 because they think it's also going to discourage women from coming forward and reporting abuse, even though there is a provision in the bill that would grant amnesty to anybody that leaves a polygamous marriage and is reporting abuse of some kind.
Amnesty that prevents them from being prosecuted for being a polygamist.
Any of the other crimes listed in the statute.
Okay. So this bill passed. What kind of chances does it have from here? Is it going to sail through the legislature?
Not sail, no. I mean, it might pass. But if we look at last year, a similar bill passed out of the House, although it did not have some of the enhanced penalties and did not have the amnesty clause. But it didn't even get a hearing in the Senate. So will this one Pass, maybe, but I sail, no.
Okay. And then does it will that mean anything? I mean, you mentioned the fact that that enforcement is difficult. Will there be any new, I guess, law enforcement aspect of this as a result of this bill?
You mean if it were to pass?
If it were to pass, yeah.
It's come up in the hearings. Well, Attorney General Sean Reyes has sent his chief criminal deputy to testify in favor of the bill. So the Utah Attorney General's office thinks this is a way to help them target some of the, the so-called child trafficking or human smuggling that goes on in the sex and some of the other crimes aside from polygamy. Now, they would still have to execute some kind of investigation or provisions of the bill to make it be successful. I don't know. I mean, the chief prosecutor said this would make it easier to go after some of the criminal organizations within polygamy.
Well, it probably would make it easier just in as much as the law that's on the books now has been shown to be unenforceable, right? I mean, they have to have something in their toolbox to be able to prosecute.
Well, are you talking about unenforceable for consenting polygamists
because of the court case that we saw that we presume is still
everyone seems to presume that if right at this moment you could not prosecute bigamy itself, polygamy itself, if it's among consenting adults.
Right. Yeah.
And generally the prosecutions that have occurred have come from other crimes, underage people being sort of forced into marriage, that kind of thing happening.
In the last half century, that's correct.
Okay. Well, again, 121-year since statehood and the polygamy ban was put into our Constitution. Nate Carlisle has been covering the story for not nearly that long. You can find his reporting at sltrib.com. Let's stick with the legislature and turn to taxes and education. David Noyce, Tribune Managing Editor. An increase in the tax on food sales. The idea is to restore the tax on groceries that was cut a decade ago. That's being floated right now. Why is it being floated right now? Tell us about this proposal.
Well, I think it's all wrapped up in education funding, of course, too, with the R schools now pushing for the ballot initiative to increase the income tax to better fund schools and get Utah out of the cellar where it's been for a long time in per pupil funding. The thinking behind the legislature, the lawmakers and the legislative leaders kind of pushing this approach is that it may not increase funding for education in the short term, but it would make the funding start to grow and more in a more predictable fashion in the future. Of course, advocates, low-income advocates, and others look at the food tax as perhaps the worst, one of the worst, if not the worst, taxes you could pass on low-income and poor people. They spend a greater deal of their income on food. Of course, they're not out there buying luxury cars or going on luxury vacations. Most of their money is going toward housing, if they can get it, and food, groceries to feed their families. And so that really hits them hard.
Is the you mentioned the education funding aspect of it, and the context here is that our schools now has launched an effort to raise $750 million through a ballot initiative, get voters to fund education that way. As a result, lawmakers are kind of trying to thwart that effort and undercut it. Is this money? I mean, is the sales tax on food, is the grocery tax going to be earmarked then specifically for education?
I don't think so. No, I'm sure it's not. As a matter of fact, what they want to do is kind of adjust other taxes as they increase that to try to sort of keep it on an equal basis, even going into where the recently passed gas tax and things like that. No, they're not promising it toward education at all. They just think it would eventually strengthen the pie, I think, in order to continue to fund education.
Increase revenue to some extent. Let's take the opinion columnist
the under Utah's constitution, the income tax, all the income tax revenues earmarked for public education. In 1996, I believe it was, they passed an amendment that says it now can go to public colleges and universities. Ever since then, those colleges and universities that had been funded with sales tax, they've started pulling education money out of those, our sales tax money out of those, and replacing with education money. So they'd stop sort of that shell game if they had a stronger sales tax base, which is what they're trying to do. They're also making it revenue neutral. That's their target, is to not make any, not generate any new revenue off of this. So in terms of actually what it would accomplish for both, not just education programs, but, you know, the social services programs, prisons, things like that, that are all funded off of the sales tax, it wouldn't actually generate any additional revenue in the short term. As Dave mentioned, their contention is that it would be a stable, it would stabilize the tax base, and it would also grow faster over time if they did it this way than if they'd leave it with the sales tax not on food. As Dave also mentioned, this is a probably the most regressive sales, or the most regressive tax you can impose. A low-income family pays much more of their income than you think about. If somebody goes out and buys a BMW, they're gonna save more and not having in reducing the sales tax, because that's the other piece of this. They're bringing it back on food. They're cutting it on everything else. So you're gonna get a tax break on your BMW while this family that's trying to make ends meet is paying more for their food.
That's the revenue neutral aspect of it is cutting elsewhere. There was a press conference yesterday. I think some faith leaders, low-income advocates. As you said, slammed this tax, this proposal. The proposal hasn't really happened yet. It hasn't been unveiled yet. Do we know when that will happen, when we'll see an exact numbers on this?
You know, as of middle of this week, they were trying to get the numbers right to make it neutral. And the other piece of this is there would probably be some sort of refundable tax credit. So when these individuals file their taxes, they can claim, you know, $100 or whatever a year in a tax credit to offset this if they're indeed on the very low end. Now, that helps some. It doesn't help others, because there is about 30% of these people on the very lowest end who actually don't file a tax return because they don't make any money or they don't make any taxable money.
Right.
So it helps some. It doesn't help all of them. They're trying to get those numbers right. They're running out of time, so they've got to do this fairly quickly, and I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see something early next week on this.
In the face of criticism, though, they're not backing down. I mean, we've seen the press conference yesterday. Others, some op-eds. Tribune itself came out with an editorial saying this was a regressive tax.
You know, I suspect the motivating factor behind this is Senator Wayne Niederhauser, who sponsored the bill that actually got rid of the sales tax on food, has never liked that, and it does create some inconsistency. They argue that the sales tax on food is a very reliable tax because everybody has to buy food. It's like taxing air, you know.
In times of recession, for example.
In times of recession, everybody's still got to buy food. Now, for low-income people, that makes it's harder during a time of recession. You cut back on other areas. But it's very stable because everybody has to eat. And so they argue if you put this back on, when you go into a recession, your tax revenues are going to be more stable in the long term. So I think Senator Niederhauser, President Niederhauser, is the one who's kind of the driving factor on this. They have backed off on the income tax adjustments that they had talked about. They had talked about getting rid of some of the deductions, phasing out deductions for people over a certain income threshold, and then lowering the income tax rate. And that was sort of more done, I think, in anticipation of the Our Schools Now initiative coming down the pike, because if they can lower the rate by 3 or 4/10 of a percent, and then even if Our Schools Now passes, then they just kind of push them back up just a little bit above where they were before, before Our Schools Now came down.
You know, that's an interesting aspect of that, the threat of this ballot initiative motivating action at the legislature. This could be conceivably a new tactic for lobbyists or for advocates of any specific cause to employ. Threaten a ballot initiative, maybe you'll see some action at the legislature.
You know, it is interesting. I mean, and these issues have polled well. I mean, they're popular issues, but they're issues the legislature won't touch. And we saw it with Count My Vote. You know, they got the changes to the election system because of their threat of a ballot initiative. We're seeing it with Our Schools Now that is threatening this ballot initiative and seems to be at least turning the heat up on the legislature to do something a little bit. We're seeing it with the medical marijuana advocates who are they haven't been able to get the legislature to act on legalizing medical marijuana, and now they're looking at a ballot initiative in 2018. It's becoming, because there are issues that the legislature, I think it's because they're a little bit out of touch with what the mainstream Utahns are hoping for or wanting to see, or don't have the political will to enact that then these groups then turn to a ballot initiative as their only option. It is incredibly hard, though, in this state to get a ballot, an initiative on the ballot. It's
the threshold is.
Yeah, I mean, we're not California. California has, you know, 100 ballot initiatives every year. This is we're a little bit more we have a higher bar to clear.
Again, the number to call is 801-355-8255 to join this conversation. That's 801-355-TALK. While we're on the topic of taxes and funding education, Democratic Senator Jim DeBacchus presented a proposal to fund education by, in his own words, soaking the rich. Dave Noyce, this was a pretty simple proposal, but one that Republican state lawmakers definitely weren't going to go for.
It rose and fall rather rapidly, yes. He wanted to raise the income tax, I guess, rate from on those making $250,000, I believe.
I think it was more. 500.
Was it 500,000?
500 for couples, 250 okay. for individuals.
To 7%, basically saying, you know, they can afford it. Let them help pay for the schools issue. And, of course, it died in committee.
Pretty quickly. Was this maybe I should turn back to Robert for this? Was this showmanship from Senator DeBacchus to make a point?
Jim DeBacchus is doing something for show. I don't think I can't fathom that. No, it was Jim knew from the outset that this wasn't going to pass, but he, you know, said that by doing this just on this one targeted group, he could raise $330 million for education. You know, there are people, particularly in the Democratic side, who say that they never should have gone to this 5% flat tax, that we were better with a graduated income tax and the rich are getting off easy. And so Jim's going to try to stick it in their eye a little bit now and then. That's sort of his MO. And, you know, it didn't pass, but it created a little bit of discussion, I guess.
Okay. Well, guys, we've got to take another quick break. When we come back, we will turn maybe from taxes to gun-related measures. There's got to be a Ben Franklin quote to help us segue there. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's David Noyce, Nate Carlisle, Robert Gerke, and Brian Maffley. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Dave Noyce, two measures having to do with gun possession or who can get a concealed permit and when, both advancing. Maybe start with the bill aiming to lower the age at which a person can get a concealed carry permit. What are they trying to do here?
I guess the age right now is 21, I believe, to get a concealed carry permit. The proposal is from a lawmaker up in Davis County. I can't remember her name now. Anyway, she's proposing lowering it to 18. Argument of 18, you're old enough to vote, you're old enough to go to war, you're old enough to do all these different things. You should be able to do that. Interesting thing in the debate is that a representative from West Jordan, Kim Coleman, sort of stunned the crowd when she talked about how she became a statistic when she was, I guess, in college, and told a reporter later that there was a rape attempt made against her, and that that a gun would be a way of keeping women safe on campus, especially on campus is a place where students can't openly carry a gun, at least in most campuses. So okay. that was one proposal.
So the measure touted as a defense for potential sexual assault victims.
Right.
The other bill also has to do with the concealed carry of a gun. First, we should say that bill did pass out of committee and is advancing.
Yes. It passed through
passed the House. Passed
the House. Yeah, oh, passed out of the House. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So headed to the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And this other bill has to do with the concealed carry of a gun as well. Tell us what it does.
This was a measure that did pass out of committee. It had stalled in the committee before on a kind of a tie vote, but two lawmakers who didn't vote before showed up this time, I guess, and voted for it and passed it along. This would essentially make it so that anyone could carry a concealed weapon, not have to get the permit, which is something that Lee Perry, the lawmaker who proposed it, tried before. Herbert vetoed and signal that he probably would do that again.
Right.
He sweetened the pot, though, or at least added a proviso this time, Representative Perry, to it has to do with domestic violence, that a person who has a protective order, restraining order, or has domestic violence conviction could not get a gun. So That's the sweetener, I guess, he's thinking could maybe persuade Herbert to
not
approve it.
To not veto this bill this time around. So-called constitutional carry. It's also, this is people who are above the age of 21 because
right.
we're creating the new provision that, or dropping the age from 18 to 21 for everybody else if these two bills go together concurrently.
If they did, yeah. Yes. Right.
Okay, well, interesting to see what happens there, and we'll keep an eye on it. Again, lots of great reporting on this topic at sltrib.com. We are running low on time, and I want to turn to Brian Maffley, Tribune Public Lands reporter. So let's go to you for a tale of deep intrigue, or at least a story that Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz has some questions about. This has to do with a tweet and what it showed. Fill us in here, Brian.
Sure. It sounds like Congressman Jason Chaffetz smelled a rat where there might not be any rat at all with a fairly innocuous seeming tweet that the Bryce Canyon National Park folks put out on December 29th, the day after Obama designated the Bears Ears Monument.
Right.
They tweeted out a photograph of the map slots at the visitor center at Bryce, showing a slot for the new Bears Ears Monument, 1.3 million acres in San Juan County. That was very controversial. And it was a kind of a happy tweet about welcome to the family of national monuments. And right. And they put it out, and I actually saw that tweet a few weeks later, and I thought very little of it. Well, apparently, Jason Chaffetz people saw it as well, and saw it as a possible evidence of, you know, coordination between the Park Service and the Obama administration prior to the Bears Ears designation.
The idea is that advanced knowledge, the Obama administration would have contacted National Park Service and said, we are going to designate this before they communicated to the state or to everybody else.
Exactly, exactly.
That's what Chaffetz is.
That's what he alleged in a, or insinuated in a letter he wrote to the interim superintendent, Susan Fritzky. About middle of January. Now, Tommy Burr and I got the letter on Monday, and it was floating around on social media, and we decided to pursue a story on it, which was in, I believe, Tuesday's paper. And it just seemed kind of strange that it went, you know, it was for Jason Chaffetz's critics, it was kind of more evidence that he's using his position as the House Oversight Committee chair to advance a partisan agenda rather than, you know, there's all these kind of obvious targets to go after associated with the new president, Donald Trump, his
right.
income tax returns, ties to Russia, whatever. He's deciding to go after Bryce Canyon National Park's
Twitter
feed, of all things. And so it really kind of annoyed people, and I think it might be the kind of thing that spurred that hostile response Chaffetz got at that high school in Cottonwood Heights a couple weeks ago.
Sure, town hall. Yeah. And again, constituents there, people who are attending this town hall saying that that Chaffetz should be looking into Trump administration conversations with Russian intelligence officials or election hacking. Robert Gerke, opinionator, this isn't going to look good to that subset of the congressman's constituents.
No, I think maybe Jason enjoys this. He enjoys pushing the buttons. He enjoys trolling his opponents because there's really, I mean, this is probably one of the more ridiculous things he could waste taxpayer money investigating. And you know, so what if there was a conspiracy and Bryce Canyon got a heads up and tweeted something? What's the end game on this? So, you know, I think he's, you know, messing with us a little bit because there are, as Brian mentioned, significant, substantial things that need to be investigated, and he's, you know, he's not touching those. He's not getting anywhere near them.
Well, we can point out that he did begin to look into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's ties and potential payments from Russia for an appearance he made in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that after Flynn resigned. He's also looking into how Trump handles sensitive information at Mar-a-Lago, his country club in Florida. Brian Maffley, you know, we're talking about the tweet that showed a slot for maps being reserved at Bears Ears. Would that actually, I mean, the opposite argument is that that's not evidence of any advanced knowledge. It's just maybe wishful thinking on the part of the Park Service.
And I think you're right. I interviewed Susan Fritzky about it, and she provided me the letter they sent to Chaffetz's office in response. They actually said they never saw this response letter dated February 2nd. But in it, the way she explained it was, you know, they have volunteers in the summer. Last summer, there was it seemed pretty clear that the Obama administration was going to designate a Bears Ears. The Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, was out here at the time. It was just a big thing in the news, and one of the volunteers who was asked to reorganize these visitor materials at the visitor center said, "Well, hey, well, why not? You know, have a slot here for Bears Ears. It's even if it doesn't become a monument, it probably deserves to have a map slot,
okay.
Given how much public attention and interest there is in that area." So it wasn't like they had the map slot was evidence of anything of advanced knowledge at all.
You didn't need a heads up. You just needed to be paying attention to know.
Yeah, read the paper.
Yeah,
a year.
Is Chaffetz's, I don't know if you want to call it a probe of the map slot issue. Can we call it map slot gate yet? Is it concluded? Yeah. Is it done, or is it just this letter? Is that all?
I have a feeling that letter is the end of it. Chaffetz's office told Tommy that it's probably at the bottom of his priority list. So I don't think we're going to see much more on it.
Okay. Well, let's move on to maybe another public lands related issue in the last couple of minutes that we have here. And Brian Maffley, there was a bill that got pulled this week that having to do with who gets to enforce drilling, or maybe better put in this instance, who doesn't get to regulate drilling in certain places. What was this
about? You're paying attention, aren't you? Because that was a pretty obscure story.
It was going to be my underplayed story, but since we've got some time left, go for it.
Oh, cool. Well, there's some concerns among members of our legislature that this anti-fracking movement we've seen in other states pushed by local jurisdictions could come to Utah. And so they want to forestall that. The Utah Petroleum Association wrote a bill for them to push, basically banning local jurisdictions or political subdivisions from regulating oil and gas, underground oil and gas operations. Surface things, they'll still get to have a say on. But under what's known as downhole operations, that's the purview of the State Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining.
So the idea is that this bill would have prevented counties from saying, for example, you can't frack here in this particular area. Is that something that counties currently can do?
Can
they say that right now as it is?
Not really. And no county has really tried to do that. Now, Grand County has tried to regulate some aspects of oil and gas activity, like the wastewater ponds have become controversial there. However, I can't think of a single instance where a county has tried to get mixed up in drilling operations.
Okay.
It's left up to the BLM and the Division of Oil, Gas, and Mine to regulate that.
So this bill got pulled and is going to be maybe reworked.
They're going to rework it this summer. But I think there is one town that is about to form, Bluff, is in the process. I got wind of this from folks in Bluff, actually. But the town of Bluff is working to incorporate. Okay, one of their big issues is to get involved in oil and gas development on their periphery.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Guys, we've run out of time and left out a couple of stories that I wanted to get to, but we need now to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, so you guys could use this time to go to those. Nate Carlisle, let's turn to you for your underplayed story. What have you got?
The state of Utah is in danger of having zero teams in the NCAA tournament. Doesn't look like BYU or Utah is going to get an at-large bid, so I think the state's last hope is if Weber State can win the Big Sky tournament, which is very possible, and there's a lesser chance that UVU could win their conference tournament. But don't look for a lot of Beehive participation in the big dance.
Don't hold your breath, especially after a great season by Utah at the start, and then it just kind of fizzled. Brian Maffley, underplayed story of the week for you.
Well, what's even more sad is the closing of the bar in Sugar House. It's a neighborhood I've lived in for almost more than 20 years, and that bar, a little tiny
used to be a tap room.
A-frame, was kind of captured the spirit of funkiness that used to be Sugar House, which is now being overrun with corporate chains and Tall buildings, and it's just not what it used to be.
Okay, the closure of a bar.
Lying in my beer over here.
There's a story at, there's a Hank Williams song. There's a story at sltrip.com. You can check that out. Dave Noyce, your underplayed story of the week.
The world champion Chicago Cubs. Geez, I never get tired of saying that. Open Cactus League play tomorrow with a split squad game against the two Bay Area teams. On the local front, the Tongan community is mourning the loss of the Queen Mother from Tonga, beloved member of the royal family. She visited Utah here twice.
Okay, check it out at sltrip.com. Robert Gerke.
Well, sort of somewhat related to what Brian was talking about, the Utah House this week passed legislation lowering the blood alcohol level from 0.08 to 0.05.
For DUIs. For
DUIs. It goes over to the Senate now. It would be the first, we would be the first state in the country to have such a low blood alcohol level. Law enforcement is concerned about it because they aren't sure exactly how they would enforce that because it's kind of hard to tell if somebody's driving at 0.05.
Okay. Well, for mine, I'm going to go with last week I mentioned the great gray owl, a bird story. Today, I'll go with another bird story via Aaron Alberti in the Tribune. Snow Geese Festival taking place in Delta, Utah. Every February, 20,000 snow geese descend on the town as part of their migration. Clouds of geese, apparently. A spectacle worth checking out. Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor Dave Noyce, Justice and Safety Reporter Nate Carlisle, Public Lands Reporter Brian Maffley, and columnist Robert Gerke, all from the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining us today, guys.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you, Roger.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and to KCPW's Emily Means. Thanks to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org, or through whatever service you use to get podcasts on your smartphone or device. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here next Friday.